It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 4 years ago this month, the Department of Environmental Protection ordered Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority to control lead levels in water for hundreds of thousands of customers. This order came after the levels topped the federal threshold of 15 parts per billion. Wednesday, PWSA and elected officials announced the water is now in compliance with EPA and DEP requirements. Margaret J. Krause covers infrastructure and transportation for WESA. So, Margaret, it was a bit of a celebration yesterday in Bloomfield where crews were replacing some lead lines in the background.
Yeah, the crew actually had to take a break so that the noise of work wouldn't overwhelm PWSA officials and elected officials, announcing that, in fact, for the first time, the agency has been in compliance with these federal and state guidelines since 2016.
But it is the cleanest water in more than 20 years.
It's the most lead-free water right. We've had in 20 years.
Yes. The latest tests that they announced show 5.1 parts per billion. That follows another test 6 months earlier where the readings were 10 parts lead. How do we know that these good numbers aren't just from one good neighborhood?
The EPA has very strict sampling guidelines for water authorities to show how their water is doing. So PWSA needs at least 100 samples from homes known to have either lead plumbing or lead service lines. And the water has to actually, when it's sampled, be sitting in that area. So it's meant to be sort of a bad picture of what it could be like. In addition, they have sites where they're monitoring throughout the system, as well as hundreds of volunteer homes where they allow PWSA employees to go in and actually sample their water on an ongoing basis. So they didn't talk about that, but that is something that's also going on.
And at one point, those lead levels actually hit 22 parts per billion. That's how bad it was. Will Pickering, executive director of PWSA, credited in part a process they started a little over a year ago.
It's a demonstration that orthophosphate is working. This is the additive that we began in April of 2019 and in the drinking water system. It's used in other cities effectively, and it's proving to be effective here and working better over time. It coats these lead service lines and prevents the water from actually touching the lead pipes that remain.
Is that universally accepted as a major reason for the lower lead levels?
There was some concern early on that simply using the EPA data, this relatively small sample size of at least 100 homes, was inconclusive or not enough to support that causal relationship. We introduced orthophosphate, therefore lead levels dropped. But given the consistency of this downward trend and this other monitoring that PWSA is doing, Will Pickering says that he feels very confident saying that there's a causal relationship, that is why it's happening, along with the lead line replacement program.
Right. The orthophosphate is a barrier between the lead in the pipes, the interior of the pipes, and the water that's flowing through.
Yes, and it's used in many other water systems and has been shown to be effective in reducing lead exposure. And the thing is, it's replacing lead lines is a physically intensive, time intensive, money intensive job that is going to take at least until 2026 to replace all the lead lines in the service area. And so in the meantime, orthophosphate, PWSA says, is the best way to protect the most number of people.
You mentioned the goal is to have the lead lines replaced by 2026, but there's still a lot more to do for the overall water system. Like what?
Well, there are many moving parts to the water system. Not least of all is the plant, the water treatment plant, which is slated for an overhaul in the coming years. But in addition, there are reservoirs that hold water. There are treatment tanks that hold water. And there are these giant distribution pipes, these mains that run from reservoirs uphill to other storage facilities. So there are these very large moving parts that are actually moving the water around between treatment and storage and distribution. And then there are these giant water mains in residential streets that some of them are more than 120 years old.
Oh my.
And those also need to be replaced, which of course is a major undertaking given that they're under streets that people use.
All these major projects are going to require lots of money. Do they even have a timetable for replacing any of those major things you just mentioned?
So I asked Executive Director Will Pickering if they have a target date for when they'll have replaced everything and they can just move to maintenance. So they don't have a target date for that. However, they do know that it's going to cost millions and millions of dollars and take many years. PennVest, which is a low interest loan fund in the state. It's a revolving loan fund. It's putting a lot of money towards it. They have requested a rate increase, but because PWSA is overseen by the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, they won't know if they can raise rates for probably not until the end of the year. PWSA is very cognizant of the fact that many of their more low-income customers, that an increase in rates would be an undue burden. So in their request to raise rates, they are saying, as we do this, we would have a program of assistance for our lower-income customers.
Will Pickering was thanking a lot of people. But he also made a point to thank the customers and talked about winning back their trust.
Yes, because in 2016, with this exceedance of the lead level, it basically blew the lid off the agency, which for many, many years was a place for political appointees to put family members, friends. No one raised rates for the longest time, and that was popular because raising rates is not a popular thing to do. But infrastructure, as we've mentioned, just falls apart. That's its nature. And so it became very obvious that they needed a professional staff, they needed to raise rates, and they needed to overhaul how they talked to customers, because customers would call in looking for help and not be able to get it, which is something that they put a lot of time and money as well into fixing over the last few years. And they are very aware that the public remains skeptical, and they acknowledge that given the agency's recent history, that that makes sense.
Margaret J. Krause is WESA's infrastructure and transportation reporter. Thanks, Margaret.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been 30 years since the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. The landmark civil rights legislation helped increase access and opportunities for people with disabilities. But advocates and activists are still looking to the future and say there's still more to be done. Dr. Josie Badger is founder and president of J. Badger Consulting and campaign manager of hashtag IWantToWork campaign. And Chaz Kellum is the director of PittServes at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Badger, let's start with you. You've worked long time to provide organizations with tools that they need to be more inclusive. What changes have you seen over the course of your career?
That's a great question. I think that the recognition of the right that people with disabilities have access to all areas of life, including going to restaurants, going to concerts, conferences, instead of really needing to argue that we have a right, it is assumed that we have the right to have access to everything that everyone else has.
The public, has their awareness, their understanding of the ADA changed over time, do you think?
I think what has changed is that they know that we have the right to be there.
Chaz, what do you think?
I also agree with Josie on that. I think we continue to have our voice be heard, which in essence has translated to more people simply being aware of the ADA.
Chaz, you've spoken in the past about the importance of both action and education. What do you think needs to be done to educate more people about the ADA and how to help our neighbors who do have disabilities?
You know, the disability community is no longer a community with our hand out for help. We want to be active and we want to help others, and we want to work collaboratively with our communities to make it better. I like to use a comparison to the civil rights movement. We continue to have progress and work to be done on that. Same with the ADA. Just because a law was passed doesn't mean that we're done advocating and educating for the rights of our community.
To both of you, what can we learn from other cities, what they're doing, other states, other countries? Dr. Badger, I'll start with you.
The biggest and interesting piece is that as you travel throughout the U.S., the most accessible communities and cities are the ones that have a lot of tourists. And so as we start to think about what accessibility physically means in Pittsburgh, we need to look at the cities around us that cater towards tourists, and how they've made transportation accessible. Places even like Alaska, where so much of their income is from tourists, that they have figured out how to make very remote areas accessible.
Chaz, what do you think? What can we learn from others, other places?
Two things. One is we have to continue to think outside the box. and try to stay ahead of legislation, ahead of what the ADA may say right now, and continue to be creative. I also think we need to continue to think about how technology can make life better for all of us.
Give me an idea, an example of how technology can improve for folks with disabilities.
So everything from robotics to assistive technology with wheelchairs to, you know, different types of parts and lightweight and how our streets and roads intersect and how we can have space for wheelchairs, infrastructure for visually impaired, and how that synergy with bicyclists and individuals that walk and how that intersection happens and how the collaboration of those things make life better for everyone.
All right. So we have policymakers, we have planners, we have developers, but what can the average person do, Dr. Badger, to make their own workplace, their neighborhood more inclusive, more accessible?
Be a part of it. When we as people with disabilities or anyone becomes a part of their community, they are going to change how disability is perceived as just something that's part of everyday life and not a separate committee, not a part of someone else's job, but it's about just being a part of the world around us and speaking up for what's right.
Finally, what do you hope is accomplished? What needs to be accomplished by the 35th anniversary, the 40th anniversary of the ADA? Dr. Badger, we'll start with you on this one.
Both Chaz and I are in our mid-30s. Sorry if I routed you out there, Chaz. But we need to make sure that we actually have young adults who are speaking up, who feel confident to speak about their rights. Those people are going to be what we as individuals who age are going to rely on.
And Chaz, what do you hope to see over the next 5 years to make it a more equitable culture, a more equitable environment?
First, I'm going to say I totally agree with what Dr. Badger said. I totally agree with that. I think it's important that we think about the intersection of other identities as we think about disability. What I mean by that is how race plays a part, how the LGBTQIA community connects with disability, how religion and disability align, and that we think about inclusion, that we are included in as many different spaces in our community as possible, that we have representation at as various spaces as possible, and that we continue to challenge the status quo, right? That we're not ever comfortable, that we're working collaboratively to push forward, and that we just continue to do all tasks, the small and the large, to continue to push our movement forward.
Chaz Kellum is the director of Pitt Serves at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Josie Badger is the founder and president of J. Badger Consulting and the campaign manager of hashtag I Want to Work campaign. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Across the country, Black and Latinx small business owners have been hit hardest by the coronavirus shutdown. But those folks have been less likely to receive federal aid than their white counterparts. A new Pennsylvania state grant program is taking a small step towards fixing that. Keystone Crossroads' Miles Bryan has more.
Lately, Talib Abdul-Mujib has spent way too much time with his hands at rest. His Philadelphia barbershop was closed for months during the shutdown. So when Mujib has customers, they take priority.
Do you mind if I ask you a couple questions when you finish up?
Yeah, I'll listen. Well, when I finish, you don't want to ask now because I got to keep working.
Mujib has spent a decade pouring himself into this place. You can see it in the carefully selected paintings by a local artist that line the walls, and in the personalized logos on the barber aprons and capes. Before the shutdown, he had up to a dozen barbers working here at once, and he did it all debt-free, something that was important to him.
And I don't want nothing from nobody. I don't need nothing from nobody. I just didn't never have that. I come from a strong family. Like my family, we don't take nothing from nobody. We don't want nothing from nobody. We could do what we do with our own intelligence and our own skills.
But then the pandemic hit, and like many thousands of other small business owners, Mujib was hit by a financial crisis he couldn't work his way out of. He quickly fell behind on rent and bills. Still, Mujeeb was reluctant to apply for grant and loan programs that have popped up to help business owners survive the shutdown. Part of that comes from the value he puts on self-reliance. But part of it is because Mujeeb was skeptical that the government and financial systems would work for him, a black small business owner.
Who doesn't in the black community have distrust for the banks? You know about the housing situation that went down where they put all these people in these upside down mortgages and all that nonsense. Just don't trust the system. I mean, let's just keep it real with you.
But Mujeeb eventually did apply, first to the federal PPP loan and now to the state grant called the COVID-19 Relief Statewide Small Business Assistance Program. He did so largely thanks to a whole lot of in-person visits from this guy, Akeem Dixon.
I've either handed a flyer out or talked to at least 30 businesses so far.
Dixon works for Beach Companies, which has been reaching out to minority small business owners in Philly and other parts of the state, trying to convince them to apply for some of the $200 million available as part of this grant.
You know, stopping to have a conversation is not convenient. Of course, if I was in a more affluent neighborhood with people that didn't really need the money, that were used to engaging the system, that had a splendid time with the system, sure, I would just send an email out and keep it pushing. But no, I'm talking to somebody that knows how easy it is for the system when you're not convenient or a part of the team to screw you over and not give you what it promised to you.
Pennsylvania officials chose to work with Beach and other community development financial institutions rather than more traditional lenders because they're better at reaching minority communities. Even so, overcoming distrust can be a challenge. Chrissy Azakar is with Finanta, a CDFI that works mostly with Latinx folks in the Philly metro area.
Even with our own clients, when we send out the information, look, there's this grant coming up, get ready. They're like, oh, no, I don't think I qualify. I'm like, yes, you do. This is for you.
Mara Shanker, who runs the Small Business Development Center at Temple University, says there are still real hurdles to getting this money. The grant requires business owners to be tax compliant. Shanker says many minority small business owners don't have easy access to capital, and some struggle to keep up with taxes, licenses, and insurance.
And Philadelphia in particular runs a very large kind of informal or gray economy where people may not have the business license or they may be, you know, working a little under the table.
Barbara Talib Mujeeb says all those conversations with Akeem Dixon and other community outreach folks have left him convinced of at least one thing, that grant and loan programs are meant for him just as much as they're meant for anyone else.
I would never have applied if they never came and talked to me about it. They emphasized to me, well, why don't you take advantage of some of the things that are out there for you?
Business owners who applied to the first round of grant relief should find out if they're funded within the next few weeks. The next round of applications opens in August. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Miles Bryant.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, Doug Schugertz, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.